If you know anything about China's modern history, you'll agree with my assessment that beauty pageants in China are a major policy development and newsworthy. And I should clarify that these beauty pageants are for pregnant women.
And they would come nonstop every night, just come to visit you in your apartment and to persuade her eventually to have abortion. And that abortion sometimes occurred very late. So there were a lot of tragedies of late-term abortion. We're talking about third trimester, even.
Did you know that China's one-child policy, that pervasive and intrusive policy that was unprecedented in human history, a policy that led to forced abortions and sterilizations of millions, was in fact never the law of the land in China, because, amazingly, it was never written into law. So if that's the case, how was this massive social policy implemented? Hey there, News Peelers. Today's April 10, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how did we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both, and let's get into it. A recent article in the New York Times features a 2020 picture of a well-known sculptor in Wuhan, a major city in China. This teal-colored sculpture was a model representation of a family of three, a mom, a dad, and their child holding the dad's hand. Next to this image from 2020, the article features a second picture of the same sculpture, but this one is from 2024. It shows that the statue representing the mom is now holding the hand of a child, who's holding the hand of another child, presumably his or her sibling. So, this sculpture was changed from representing a family of three to representing a family of five, which reflects China's new three-child policy. But how do we get here from China's infamous one-child policy, which, far from celebrating multiple pregnancies, punished second pregnancies? And the legacy of China's one-child policy continues to impact everything in China today, from China's gigantic economy, to its growing military, to its pension funds, and elderly care. With respect to elderly care, the New York Times featured two contrasting images. One shows a worn-out, dated tile work from decades ago on an aging building's exterior wall, stating, "One child is best. The government aids in elder care." The other image shows a recent prominent red banner stretching from tree to tree on a roadside with the following message: "Three children are best. No need for state-supported elder care." Pretty different, right? China is now pushing and promoting families to have multiple children, a reversal of its one-child policy that officially ended in 2015. By the way, as explained by the New York Times, most families in China are ignoring these family planning promotions, and many ridicule them on social media, mainly because most families don't have the funds to raise more than one child. To better understand how China got here, the history of China's population surge, and the Chinese government's brutal efforts to slow its population growth, I spoke with Dr. Feng Wang some time ago. It's a fascinating conversation that is relevant now. Dr. Wang is a professor of sociology at the University of Irvine, UCI, He has a research interest in contemporary Chinese society and comparative demographic processes and social inequality in state socialism. He has received many academic distinctions, honors, and awards for his research and books, too many to list here. His latest book is China's Age of Abundance, Origins, Ascendance, and Aftermath. His other books include the following: Convergence to Very Low Fertility in East Asia, Processes, Causes, and Implications, and also One Quarter of Humanity, Malthusian Mythology and Chinese Realities, 1700 to 2000. To learn more about Dr. Wang and his extensive research, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Wang and I peel the history behind this news. You can put a face to these podcasts by visiting our YouTube channels, youtube.com/@historybehindnews, and also youtube.com/@unraveling the Middle East. I've also dropped links to these YouTube channels below. Now, let's get back to peeling the history behind our news. So, Professor Wang, it is such a pleasure to have you on our show today. I have followed your work and research for some time, including your contributions to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and other prominent publications. So I'm very excited for our conversation now. Thank you for taking the time for it, sir.
Adele, it's a pleasure to be in this program. I admire what you do. We do need to read and reflect on the history we have traveled. So I'm glad to be here on this topic.
So let's start. What was China's one-child policy that continues to create controversy several years after it's been officially abandoned?
Well, we have to take ourselves back to the latter half of the last century. In the 1960s and 1970s, this is a time when the world was living under the Malthusian scare. And
what you mean by that, if I may interrupt you, please? Malthusian scare. What you're talking about is that population is going to grow. There's going to be a shortage of food, and there's going to be a catastrophic population decline. Is that a correct way of saying that?
It was the population explosion.
Yes.
And I think there was this book by a Stanford biologist, Paul Ehrlich, which had a title called The Population Bomb.
Oh, boy. That sounds ominous.
The scare had its reasons. That is, if it's just looking at the world population growth, it doubled in merely 40 years from about 3 billion in 1960 to over 6 billion by 2000. So the world population was growing at a speed that the world had not seen before, not during the Malthusian times.
Wow.
And
wow.
China was the largest population in the world, had always been the largest population in the world. And this unprecedented population explosive growth was driven by something that's spectacularly beautiful, which was the lengthening of human lifespan. So in the 20th century, the average lifespan of the whole world population doubled. That had never happened before.
That's wonderful. The testament to 20th century medicine and, I guess, relative peace, right?
Right. So, but with this drastic mortality decline, a lot of people who would have died early on survived. Children survived to become adults. So China under socialist...
What you're referring to is lower infant mortality, right?
Exactly.
Okay,
we're talking about infant mortality from 10-20% to 1% or half of a percent.
Infant mortality used to be 10 to 20%. My goodness.
Well, when life expectancy was about 35 to 40 years, only half of all birth would survive to adulthood. So you have 20% or 25% would die during the first year. Anyway, so for China, under the socialist system, with all its criticisms of the system, a great achievement was a drastic decline in mortality. So population growth in China was extraordinarily fast as well. So the speed at that time was going to double the population size once every 35 years.
Professor Wang, so I just want to couch this for myself and our listeners. Despite everything that was happening during Chairman Mao's leadership, including the Great Famine, China actually went through a significant population spurt. That's what you're saying.
Exactly. And then largely due to the public health and also a egalitarian food distribution policy under the Maoist socialist policies. So China in the late 1970s,
wow, interesting,
time of Mao's death, saw its population growth at a very fast rate, and also had another challenge. That is, under the planned economy system, China had a constant shortage of food, of jobs, of classrooms. So for China, the challenge of population growth was especially daunting. So for the new leadership, they really need to put a brake on what they saw was a runaway population explosion. Okay. So when the Wanchao policy came to the scene, this was 1979, 1980, China...
And by this time, Chairman Mao has been dead for 3 years, two or three years. Am I correct?
For 3 years. And then the new leadership changed the legitimacy of the new leadership no longer on revolutions, class struggles, but on improving people's standard of living. And so they made a very simple calculation. How do you do, how to improve standard of living? Is your economic output divided by the number of people you have?
This is math.
This is very simple math. So people were just counted as numbers. And also they were worried about the large number of people born after the famine in the early 1960s. And they were coming of age in the 1980s and they would need jobs. Also, they would become parents themselves. So all those things put together, the global cloud of population explosion, the Chinese rapid population growth during socialist time, and the new mandate of the post-Mao leadership. So add together, the leadership decided that they need to do something even more drastic. And so they were doing something that's, in a way, they were mortgaging the future. They were saying, okay, let's just push this, sacrifice one generation, let's achieve our goal. So how to do that? You restrict the number of children per couple to the smallest as possible. And that's one child per couple.
It's a bit of an irony to improve the lot of their population, to the living standards of people. They actually exercise a heavy hand, in a sense, to go about that. They leave Mao, and this is really a sort of an intrusive, restrictive policy, right?
Well, it's incredibly intrusive, and it has never happened elsewhere, and not in Chinese history, and especially in a society where family has always been cherished as the core of the as the basis of the social foundation. And the society, the culture, is a culture that emphasized on family, on king, on family values, on respect for the elderly. So here is a extreme policy that would cut the Chinese society from its very foot by altering forcefully the king networks, families, compositions of the Chinese families.
So Wang, this really piqued my interest, this pervasive intrusive policy. So I took it upon myself. I went and researched China's constitution to look for this policy. In China's constitution, there are many different articles. You're more familiar with it, obviously, than I am. And I found references to family planning and what have you, sort of vague in general, but I didn't see anything about a one-child policy. A policy of this enormity that, as you said, just goes down granularly to the very heart of the family value, I assume it would be in the Constitution. Am I missing amendments? Is this codified somewhere? How did this come about legislatively? Is it like the U.S. where provinces need to ratify this?
This is one of the most unnoticed and also the most ironic part of the history of the one-child policy, and which is the policy itself has never been written into explicitly any Chinese laws, be it the constitution, the marriage law, or even the family planning law itself. So we have to understand how the Chinese society was run, and also the politics of this. So the society was coming out of the Cultural Revolution. China was rebuilding its legal system. So the society was not ruled by law. And it's by mass movement. It's by the orders from the Communist Party. So that's one aspect. And so you don't have to have laws in order to do things in China then. Even now, but much less than back 40 years ago.
If I may interrupt you for just one moment. So 1979, this is the implementation begins. So let's say it's 1992. Is there writing anywhere about this? Do party leaders point to any text for this? Do you see, as an American, how this is so enigmatic and foreign to me?
Well, yes and no. Okay. So one aspect is the importance or the unimportance of law.
That's interesting. Importance or unimportance. Okay.
In the land of China. Well, the constitution early on also, I think even now, I have not checked the latest constitution, guarantees the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly. You know, it's like copied from other constitutions. Yeah. You know, Chinese population, I think they removed this later on, but the constitution back in 1980 had guarantees for assembly, for freedom of speech, for religious belief. And we know, you get censored all the time these days. Anyway, so law is not that important, that's one aspect. The other part is politics. While most of the leaders were in agreement in controlling population, the extreme measure was not supported by everyone at very high levels. So the policy came out as a letter to call for party members and members of the Communist Youth Leagues to make a sacrifice and to have only one child. So it was not even that letter in September 1980, published in the People's Daily and in the public, that was not a law. That was not even a requirement to the general population. So
it almost sounds like a plea, like an entreaty, make a sacrifice.
It was a plea. And if you read the letter, it actually says, this is not a policy that's consequence neutral. It has negative consequences. And they anticipated some of them. And also said in 30 some years from now, from 1980, when China would be a different society, then we would have different policy. So it was framed as a one generation policy, but because of the politics and the embarrassment, the hesitation that this is such an extreme policy. So the central government delegated every province to have regulations. So when you say, well, whether the one child policy was a law, it was not a formal law, but it was regulations formulated by every province in China. So it's a local regulation. And then the policy over time also was modified. They allowed more exemptions, and they allowed the rural couples to have two children if the first one is a boy.
Is that because rural couples needed, I guess, boys for more intensive labor in the countryside? Is that it?
Well, 40 years ago, 80% of the Chinese population were living in the countryside.
Interesting.
And they relied on farming as livelihood. Okay. So imagine not only you need to have a son who would be labor, and also if you only have a girl, the Chinese custom was that the girl would marry off to go to live with the groom's family. So you would end up childless.
Meaning you lose that offspring, yeah.
Right.
Interesting.
So that's how the one-child policy got started.
Interesting. Professor Wang, why don't we take a short break and then talk about the impact of one-child policy in China's people? We'll be back in a moment.
How do China's bureaucratic institutions work? This almost sounds like a boring academic question, right? But what I learned from my conversation with Dr. Susan Shirk in Season 2, Episode 36, was neither boring nor academic. It was frightening and quite real. Dr. Shirk, formerly a State Department diplomat in charge of China, shares the story of how Xi Jinping cunningly dominated the center of power, shrewdly working his way in from the fringes, and how once at the helm, he changed the very rules that got him there to prevent others from gaining power the way he did. But what about China's bureaucratic institutions that I mentioned? To me, that is the real frightening development in China. How the heads of different government agencies, like good, obedient children, base major national policies on mere words and passing hints made by President Xi, and they outcompete one another to carry out what they believe to be his wishes. This erosion of institutionalized government in favor of personalized rule by one man is a major issue for the world, because we're talking about China, not some random small country with no impact on world economy and geopolitics. I've dropped a link for you to this amazing episode with Dr. Shirk. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Wang about China's population control.
So, Professor Wang, we talked about the 1980 letter in which it called for sacrifice by party leaders. And I said, this sounds like a plea. And you said, yes, it really was. So pardon this question, because it's going to come out naive, because I'm asking this question as an American, as my life experience. So let's say it's 1985, whatever, during this one-child policy, and we do have, my spouse and I do have a second child or a third child. Does the police show up? Is there punishment? How is this enforced? Is there reward?
There was a very trivial reward. But mostly the one-child policy was implemented as any other policies in China at that time.
Which is?
Mass campaign and combined with a strong punishment.
First of all, mass campaign, you mean propaganda campaign, that sort of thing.
Propaganda, mobilization, study sessions, and people watching each other, reporting each other.
Oh, jeez.
So you have, I mean, this is the traditional way of governance, is through mass mobilization. In a way, it's almost like a mass terror. It's a collective society, right? And so people are doing this to help the nation, to help everybody else. Okay. So, but the punishment was not uniformly effective. So depending where you are, there are a bell in the 1980s. So if you were a lucky one, under the socialist system, you were working in the cities, you were guaranteed jobs and housing and food rationing, everything, healthcare.
When you say lucky one, does this apply to blue collar and white collar workers, or is this or compared to villages? Is that what you mean, lucky one?
It means that you're not living in the countryside.
Okay, you got that.
A state employee.
Got
it. So if you're a lucky one, this is your unlucky moment. So the government could kick you out from your job. Could deny your promotion and could fire you. So you could lose everything. So
you've gotten lucky, and from your village through connections or through personal merit, you've gone, let's say, to Beijing and you work for a prominent government institution. And they find out you or your wife is pregnant for a second time. This can have reprisals, that you could be fired?
You will be fired. People were fired.
Oh, wow.
And and then also, even before you had the second child, they would discover that your wife was pregnant, and they would come nonstop every night, just come to visit you in your apartment and to persuade her eventually to have abortion. And that abortion sometimes occurred very late. So there were a lot of tragedies of late-term abortion. We're talking about third trimester, even. They really need to make
sure. Past 6 months?
Yes. They really need to make sure that the child was not born. But if you were the unlucky one under socialist arrangement, you were mostly farming, living on your own. The government could not do much, right? They could. Eventually, there were cases where actually they took away your draft animal. They actually imprisoned illegal means, just village cells.
If they take away their draft animals, that these people in the countryside may starve.
Yeah, and then some people's, some local officials destroyed farmers' families' properties, and because they were so frustrated, because these local officials were pressured to make sure that the out-of-plan birth did not happen. So there was a lot of coercion and a lot of brutality to implement such a policy.
Professor Wang, you said you were talking about sort of supervisors and people that work in government institutions, and you used the following phrase. You said they really needed to make sure that you don't have another child. Would the bosses, the supervisors within these government institutions get in trouble if their employees had multiple children? Is that sort of a hierarchy? Is that how it came down?
That's exactly how this was done. So
I see.
The population was planned as trees or as cement sticks. So they had quota, and they had numbers for allowed for every province, every city, every county, every township, and down to every village and every factory. And also they had a high, 500,000 people were hired eventually to do this job.
500,000 people?
Yes. The bureaucracy had 500,000 people.
That's a powerful bureaucracy in and of itself.
It was also an irony because before the end of the policy in 2015, every other bureaucracy was getting smaller. But this bureaucracy was getting bigger.
As the policy itself was waning, the bureaucracy continues on and strengthens. That is ironic.
And the bureaucracy also played a very active and meaningful role in resisting the change of the policy. It became a vested interest itself.
I think you just answered one of my upcoming questions, which is, if this was such a draconian, brutal regime, if you will, I'm not talking about the China's government, I'm just talking about this specific regime of family planning. It took so long to get rid of it, partly because of the bureaucracy, a well-entrenched bureaucracy. Is that it?
It certainly was one of the factors. So when the policy was announced nationwide in 1980, it said very explicitly in the letter, in about 30 years, China would be a different country and the policy would be a different policy. So even that was anticipated. So by the turn of the century, by year 2000, China was already a very different society. It was much richer. And the per capita income goal set back in 1980 was more than fulfilled. And also was important, not only in China, elsewhere in the world, people misunderstood why population explosion occurred. It was not because people had more birth. It's because more birth survived. So after the period of for the mortality decline, people would adjust their behavior. And so that's why we see birth rate is so low and it's getting lower in more and more countries today. So what happened was in the early 1990s, China's birth rate or fertility already dropped to below 2 children per couple. And it was not clear to what extent this was due to the policy. The one-child policy was only in place for less than a decade and a half. And what was due to China's spectacular economic boom, migration, urbanization, education.
Also, if I may please, more educated women are reluctant to have children earlier in life. Is that a fair assessment?
Somewhat.
It's not similar to the United States and Western Europe. Then,
the higher education expansion did not occur until the end of that decade.
I see.
So by 2000, that's 20 years after the one-child policy, and China already had a different demographic profile and different economy. The natural thing is to start think about this costly policy to Chinese families, right? And not everyone was subject to the policy. Some rural families could have 2 children, but the majority of Chinese couples, over 60%, were subject to the one-child policy.
Did China's leaders also adhere to this policy? For example, does President Xi only have one child?
Yes. So that's the other side of this policy. There's very little corruption. People really bought.
That's amazing. Wow. Because I wouldn't have thought that.
People really bought into this. And so President Xi has only one daughter. And so does the prime minister.
So we're not talking about a potential for a male dynasty here.
That, ironically, is not a possibility. It turns out that the top leaders of China collectively, the 7 and most powerful men, are the members of the standing committee of the Politburo. They only have five children, and I think five are girls. So
that's, in a country that prefers boys, right?
Right. Yeah. So anyway, so you would expect China would start to think about a different policy, but the one-child policy continued for another 15 years until 2015. And there are a number of reasons to this. One is that the public, Chinese public, really bought into this, believing that they need to make the sacrifice. And everyone from the very top, the leader, obeyed policy. And so that's one aspect. And the other aspect is this bureaucracy, this birth control bureaucracy that got expanded and really got itself into a powerful position and arguing in particular that birth rate dropped in China precisely because of the one-child policy. So they were playing up the role of this policy, saying that if China, here's what you have. In the early 2010s, just 2 years before the policy was lifted, the government branch, their scholars came out with a warning that if one-child policy were lifted, the annual birth could go up to 23 million. Okay, so
what happened?
Well, last year, the number of birth was less than 15 million.
Wow, 7
so
million less than that.
They clearly played up. Well, this will scare the leaders that believing that the policy was the key in keeping the birth rate low. And you couldn't have a alternative unless you lift this. And that's what happened in 2015.
Professor Wang, why don't we take a short break and we'll be right back. Thank you.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Professor Wang, earlier you shared with me that nothing like this to this extent had ever been done for this duration. In a previous conversation, you and I talked about India, which had this short-lived, really brutal policy of sterilization. Would you like to just talk about that a little bit?
Of course. China was not the only country that was so scared with the runaway population growth in the second half, the last quarter of the 20th century. So China was the largest country. And then you turn around, the second largest was India. And India was also...
And India was fast closing that gap, right? The growth was almost astronomical at that time. Am I correct?
Was growing very fast due to the same reason. Mortality was dropping and population was getting healthier. But not as fast as China.
Not as fast as China, okay.
In 1983 or 82, early 1980s, also stepped on the brakes. So they had a massive sterilization campaign.
How massive when you say massive?
We're talking about tens of millions of sterilizations were carried out in a single year. And
good God.
Wow. And so what happened was that here's the difference between India and China.
Mm-hmm.
India, for better and worse, is known as the largest democracy in the world. So it does, and they did have elections. So the governing party under the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who was Gandhi's is the daughter of the first Prime Minister of the new India.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very effective leader, very powerful, and she was overthrown.
Because of that policy?
Because of that. So
wow.
They lost the election. So that's how severe it was. Not the same in China.
Because China was not a democracy. China,
and also the Chinese people just bought into this.
Interesting.
And in 1983, that China also had a sterilization campaign just a couple of years after the Wenxiao policy. They really want to clean the field. Two out of every five pregnancies were aborted.
In China?
China.
Oh, boy.
So a year... What,
was there also a sterilization of women in China?
Tremendous. So
tremendous, wow.
In 1983, there were 20 million babies born, 14 million aborted. Fetus is aborted. 14.
Oh, my God.
And sterilization, 17 million. So,
abortion is not a lightning rod political issue as it is here in the Western world and the Christian.
Right. It's right? not. It's not the same. It's not. We don't have the same kind of moral debate.
Yeah.
So, but in China, the government was not affected, and there were backlashes. And that's why 84 to 86, 1986, the government started to give in to the people in the countryside and allowed a policy that's more lenient for people in the countryside.
But it continued with state employees and urban populations, right?
So, it's they had no place to escape.
Exactly.
Had to come.
Professor Wang, I want to close off our conversation about the historical aspect of the one-child policy with the children. I thought about this over the weekend when I was at my parents' house with my siblings and our children, so three generations, and it sort of occurred to me, yes, these children of one-child policy, by definition, don't have siblings. But they probably didn't have aunts or uncles or cousins either. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So this is the most, I think, long-lasting consequences of the one-child policy. The policy lasted for 30 years. It ended, but it created something like 100 million families. It's one in three. In China, with only one child, right? And we don't actually know what's the full consequences of this forcefully alteration of the kin network, of family structure, and of the effect on children and on their parents as well. So
it's almost like an upside down pyramid, four grandparents and two parents and then one child. You see what I mean? Like the support system is almost turned upside down, where we used to be much wider. The base used to be down with many, many children. Is that a fair assessment, sir?
That's exactly what's happening. And so you have two children with four parents and, two only children with four parents. And that has tremendous implications. Here we're looking at two sources of old age support. When we look ahead, so you rely on the society, to the government, to provide all the support because you only have one child. So you can't count on only child to provide all the support. But the very same family structure you just described, 4-to-1, is going to be aggregated to the whole society. So you're going to have a top-heavy population age structure with more and more elderly and with a smaller bottom with younger population with smaller and smaller share. And what's also important, we don't quite understand this yet, is why birth rate in China is so low.
Continues to be so low after the abandonment of the policy, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So how much of that was because the only children themselves feeling that they need to support their parents in the future, they don't want to take up more jobs to have more children to support as well? Well, how much of that is a normalization of a norm, which is abnormal? That is, if you ask people in almost every society, what's the ideal number of children? How many would you like to have? Overall, it's 2 children, 1 boy, 1 girl. I think that's kind of the ideal family children size. So by having a one-child policy for 35 years, you look around and I'm only child, everyone else is only child, we seem to be fine. So
it's culturally normal. It's the norm.
Right. So something that was abnormal in the societal cultural setting, which is you're the only child, now is quite prevalent. So to what extent that's also contributing to the very low fertility in China, we don't know. So you do have these ripple effects. The outcomes of this unparalleled policy of birth control in human history.
I see. Professor Wang, please stay with me as we get into the perspective of this episode. Okay.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Professor Wang, can you please give me some perspective on what happens now to the livelihood of China's elderly? Who's going to pay for all these grandparents? Are we talking about Social Security? Are we talking about private pensions, government pensions? There's only one kid. Do we have a, I guess if I may phrase it this way, and I hope I'm not being hyperbolic here, do we have a looming pension crisis in China?
It's coming. It's coming. It's going to be
worse than the ones in Western Europe and North America.
It's much worse than the one in North America. It could be worse than the ones in Western Europe as well. It's because China to become a what's called an aging society, that is to have 15 to 25% of its population aged 65 and over. For China to travel to that benchmark, it took less than 30 years. And for Western European societies, they're also aged now, but it took 100 years or 70 years. So the aging process is very compressed. And you have what we discussed of so many families with only one child. So you have both an aggregate pressure, that is the ratio between the elderly population who need to have some kind of pension support and the population you can take taxes from, the working population. So you have that ratio. It's getting higher and higher, the more, yeah. So, and then at the same time, you're looking at each individual family. It's not just money. You also have to have time to spend with your aging parents. You need your aging parents need somebody to get them to the hospitals.
Precisely, which really segues into this other looming issue that I see: healthcare for the elderly. They need at-home nursing. They need nursing homes. They need people to literally physically, the physicality of it, wheel them to the nursing. Who does this? These are young people are supposed to do this.
Well, China has gotten a lot richer. So get a lot more wealthier now. China is the upper middle income society with a lot of inequality. But money cannot buy everything.
Exactly.
And you need people to, at a certain stage of people's lives, you need to have people to help you to make the decisions, to pay the bills. There is a point where you just cannot pay your own bill. So these instrumental support will put a lot of pressure on the only children. And also, you know, parents are parents. They're human beings. And they raise their children for an emotional reason. So you need to have the time to talk with your children and to have your children come to visit you. So all those.
So you're talking about lower quality of association between families and generations?
Lower quality. I mean, that's what makes human life human life.
Exactly.
So all these generational boundaries, or these are invisible sacrifices. You know, for instance, I won't be surprised to hear that more and more elderly just die alone in their apartments without anybody noticing them. The fastest growing family household type in China now is one person, single or single generation, just elderly, one couple households. That's going up really, really fast. And some of this is because young people are not getting married. So just like in the United States, but others are just elderly living by themselves.
That's both frightening and sad.
So people are making adjustments and make adapt. Well, human beings, we can always adapt, but it's not a enviable and a pleasant life that is very much dictated in Chinese culture. When you say parents invested in their children and to give everything to their children, and they also say children should support their parents. And there's a reason for that to be in the Chinese culture. It's a very valuable aspect of any culture. But that it's going to be very difficult to fulfill right now. And for the state, the bill for pension and for healthcare will run up very quickly. And that's going to constrain China's global economic and military ambitions.
You think that'll, I feel like you're about to go into how this may impact U.S.-China relations, or is this much hype? Is this just exaggeration? From what you're saying, I feel like you're making a real case about how aging population may impact this relationship.
Yes and no. No, in the sense that demography is a slow-moving process. So we're not going to see this, like, say, next year or the year after next. But 15, 20 years down the road, the United States and China will be two very different societies demographically. The United States would more or less maintain its current population age structure, while China would be much, much older. And so that has a whole slew of consequences in terms of, we certainly do not want to go into military confrontation, but if that's something on the table, it's very hard to conscript people into the army when you have very aging society, very few young people.
Or when you are an only son or only daughter and you're caring for your parents and even grandparents, you know.
And that
used to be an exemption in the Western Europe and America if you were the only child. I think it was. So that's a big deal.
For a good reason.
For good reason.
That one child, something happens to the one child, the parents would be left heirless and nobody would be looking after them. And I think in general, an older China is going to be a kinder and more peaceful China. And
that would be great.
The preoccupation, I think that's why I think there's so much hype about a military confrontation, about global instability. We have to understand both China and the United States are large countries that the majority of the problems they have to deal with are domestic.
Yeah.
They have to deal with the
domestic.
So the United States has a history of being an international policeman. It's, you know, goes into peacekeeper or whatever. But China does not have that tradition. And the domestic challenges associated with rapid population aging, large share of families are so weak, will constrain China a lot more than is the case for the United States. So,
interesting. China, this is a conversation that most Americans are not privy to. They don't look at it this way because it's not probably as exciting as talk about, quote unquote, the threat of China, right?
I mean, that's not what we see in the news media.
Exactly.
And look at China. In 30 years, one out of every three persons would be age 65 and over. And how would
one out of three? Wow.
So how would it want to launch a war with the United States?
One thing that I noticed, and this is just a comment, I don't really have a question, but it's interesting reading your publications and following China's population growth. One thing that I noticed that the U.S. has that is entirely missing in China's recent history anyway, it's immigration. Immigration adds, contributes. And I don't want to get to this political aspect. I'm just talking about demographics. It's really a driver of our population versus China doesn't have that.
No other country has what we have in the United States. There are a few countries that have a lot of immigrant countries. And you look at Canada, you look at Australia, but the United States is supremely unique in this aspect. It's an immigrant society. It draws people, just not everybody, it draws positive selection talents from all over the world. And we know this society has the dynamism that other countries with long traditions do not have.
It's one of our strengths.
It's absolutely one of our strengths. And also demographic, they keep this country young, relatively speaking.
Yeah. After hearing what you had to say, you definitely want to keep the country young.
And also, immigration would continue in this country. But immigration is very, very hard for a homogeneous Chinese society. So we have a lot of issues with racial relations.
Yeah.
And we are making transformations. The society is changing. But China is always a Han population, majority dominated country. And that's been the case for centuries, if not longer.
Exactly, the Han majority since.
And so that is not something China can learn, can adapt. It's just not possible. China has not even begun to learn how to deal with race and ethnicity. And we hear a lot of complaints these days.
Immigration, bringing in immigrants, assimilating them into our society is something that America is uniquely positioned for. Professor Wang, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. You're welcome to our show, to the Peel.News anytime. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past. Rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.